In a New Yorker profile of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg last September, Evan Osnos writes, "If Facebook were a country, it would have the largest population on Earth, more than 2.2 billion people, about a third of humanity, log in at least once a month. That user base has no precedent in the history of American enterprise. 14 years after it was founded, in Zuckerberg's dorm room, Facebook has as many adherents as Christianity." But there's a dark side to that extensive success. Our special guest on this KBOO News and Public Affairs Day is Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. In his role as a tech investor, Roger was a mentor to Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg in the company's startup days. His most recent venture capital fund, Elevation, included U2's Bono as a co-founder. Roger earned a BA from Yale and an MBA from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He served as a technical advisor on the HBO show Silicon Valley, and amazingly, he still finds time to sing and play bass and guitar in the bands Moon Alice and Doobie Decibel System. Roger McNamee, welcome to KBOO.
Ken, it's so great to be back.
Roger, many of us at KBOO are fans of your band Moon Alice, and that's how I first heard of you. What I didn't know at the time, you also have a long, successful career as a venture capitalist for high-tech. Early in Zucked, you write of playing in a band called Guff as an undergrad at Yale and meeting your wife, Anne, in a music theory course you were taking. How did you go from there to professional investor? I guess that's a long story.
It's funny because I never intended to be in the investment business. It was not a goal of mine. The challenge that I faced was that I loved playing music, and Guff was a really cool band. And you have to imagine, we're talking 1979, 1980. It was a period of time when it was still, you know, the record industry was still really happening, right? And we were sort of at this really weird intersection of Frank Zappa, the Grateful Dead, and punk.
Wow.
And the punk part was that we weren't as good on our instruments as we were at songwriting. And we had a really good following, but we weren't confident enough to go and make a career out of it. And the problem was, I'd paid my own way through college, and I'd borrowed a lot of money to do it. And I'm one of these people who, if I borrow money, I pay it back. And so I needed to get a real job. And Anne, who at that time was my fiance, is my wife, she got a job as a professor at Swarthmore College. And so she was going to be in Philadelphia. And so my challenge was to find something in Philadelphia, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't find anything that didn't like completely freak me out. So I went to grad school for 2 years thinking, well, that'll buy me some time.
That's an old strategy.
Exactly. And so while I'm there, I'm playing music, you know, and getting all my pin money from playing music. But obviously playing music after grad school, I borrowed a lot more money, so that wasn't going to work. And so I looked for jobs that would just be interesting. And again, I couldn't find anything in Philadelphia, but I found one in Baltimore working at a mutual fund company called T. Rowe Price, and to be a research analyst. And you have to imagine, in those days, if you went to be a research analyst on the stock market, that was not a way to get rich. It was really just an interesting, sort of vaguely academic gig. And when I arrived at T. Rowe Price, it was literally the first day of the bull market of 1982. And they assigned me to technology. Now, in an industry where timing is everything, it's pretty hard to top that starting condition. I had a tailwind my entire life after that, which is frankly the only way it could possibly have worked. Because if you know anything about me, you know pretty quickly that I do not actually have the makeup that you normally associate with Wall Street, and particularly not with, you know, the sort of money management where people are very oriented towards.
No, you seem more in the musician mold.
Well, I was, you know, I really wanted to keep playing music. And so I wanted a gig where, you know, I could go home in the evening and either practice or play gigs. And being a research analyst in the early 80s was just like that. It was like a vaguely academic gig. And what was interesting, though, was that I got there when Silicon Valley's focus was still on the space program. I mean, I got there just as the space shuttle was becoming operational. So making space shuttles was still a big deal. And it was only the following year that the personal computer industry became an industry. And so I vectored over to cover that. And I had this really cool thing. I was the same age as all these people, right? I mean, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs were a year older, but pretty much everybody was the same age. We all, you know, we all liked the same music. We took the same drugs. So that was an industry where, you know, they didn't go out to bars the way that most industries did when they were on the road. They would bring instruments and have a jam session. And I discovered, I mean, talk about dumb luck. I show up in this industry and I'm just a research analyst. I'm a nobody. But they have these jam sessions and I stumble into one of them. And they have this problem. Everybody knows a verse and a chorus, but that's all they really know. And they barely know that. I'd been playing happy hours for years, so I knew hundreds of songs. So I was like the jukebox that kept the jam sessions going. So suddenly I discovered the fact that I played music was like my entry ticket into the computer business.
And you even played with Paul Allen, right?
A lot. That was the whole point. When you showed up at these things, it wasn't just anybody who was there. I mean, you could have Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. Philippe Kahn, who was the founder of Borland, which is a big software company in that era. The chief technology officer at Apple was a drummer. The guy who ran developer services at Apple was a guitar player. There were all these other people who were out of the industry. And so you might have a dozen people who'd get together. And, you know, maybe five or six would play on each individual song, and then we'd trade instruments and go on. But because I knew the most songs, I played on pretty much everything. And that evolved into this thing that became known as the Random Axes. And the Random Axes were this pickup band that wound up playing really cool gigs, including, you know, we'd get big stages up at these, eventually it evolved into a real thing. And, you know, there were all these people from the music business who used to like hanging out around the computer industry. So, you know, you'd have people from like, you know, the Doobie Brothers and all these other bands who'd be there. And so you'd get to play with them. And it was, you know, it was really, really fun. And the thing is, again, it was about changing the world. It wasn't about getting rich or anything. And Silicon Valley remained in that kind of hippie libertarian model, the sort of Stuart Brand, Whole Earth Catalog, Merry Pranksters influenced vibe right through to 2000 or so. You know, once the internet bubble burst in 2000, then the air came out of the balloon. You know, we really, it went through a radical transformation. And one of the things that changed was the culture, which moved from the one that I was comfortable in to this libertarian, Ayn Randian, build a monopoly, get incredibly wealthy, take over the world kind of thing, which was a very different value system and one that didn't fit me well at all.
So let's talk about that transition there. The T. Rowe Price job, you mentioned starting during the bull market in 1982. So let's go 24 years later in 2006. You were asked to mentor Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, no, I wasn't asked to mentor him. I was asked to just take a meeting with him.
Oh, that was it. Okay.
Yeah, no. Hang on. Imagine the story. Okay. Here's the setting. It's 2006. Mark has just turned 22. The company is barely 2 years old. They have practically no revenue. They're still available only to high school students and college students with their school address, email address. But I'm already convinced that this is going to be the next big thing. It's going to be as important as Google was at that time. And the reason was because of that very fact of the authenticated identity. I was convinced that that was what was wrong with MySpace and America Online and Friendster and all the early efforts at social networks were basically undone because of trolls and bullies, that anonymity allowed people to be inauthentic and then to really to beat up on folks who didn't deserve it. But Mark had this thing that was built around real identity. And I was convinced that that was going to give him a chance that other people had not had.
You mentioned graph theory, too, in the book as one of his...
Yeah, well, so the reason that authenticated identity mattered was because he had taken a notion out of mathematics called graph theory and figured out that it was a really great architecture for a network. But in order for it to work efficiently, each person on the network could only be represented by a single address. So authenticated identity was perfect because it basically, it was helpful to building the network. And it was helpful for keeping peace on the network at the same time. And I looked at this before I even met the guy and go, I think this is really brilliant. And he's 22. So he comes into my office. And Ken, I have to set the scene again. So I'm at a firm at that time called Elevation. I have five partners, but three of them are worth noting for the purpose of this conversation.
One of them is
a rock and roll star right. from Dublin named Bono. One of them was the former chief financial officer of Apple, a guy named Fred Anderson, who had saved Apple from bankruptcy and was the guy who actually brought Steve Jobs back into Apple. And then the former president of the world's largest video game company, John Riccitiello, who had been at Electronic Arts. And our goal was to basically invest at the intersection of technology and media in a rapidly changing landscape. So we're very focused on video games, and we've taken one of the conference rooms in our office and turned it into a living room with a giant, well, what was then a giant flat panel TV with monster speakers and every possible video game console. And then we had this giant arcade thing with literally, it was a simulator that you would use in any video game company that had an emulation of every arcade video game ever made, like 5,400 different games. But the room was soundproofed to within an inch of its life because otherwise you could never use it during office hours. And so Mark comes to my office and meets me in there. So it's dead quiet, just the two of us, as far apart as we are, so roughly 3 feet between us. He's in one comfy chair. I'm on a different one. I say, Mark, you don't know me. Once you start talking, you'll assume that anything I say after that is affected by what you've said. So give me 2 minutes to give you some context for why I'm taking this meeting. And I say, here's the deal. If it hasn't already happened, either Microsoft or Yahoo is going to offer $1 billion for Facebook. And everybody you know, your parents, your board of directors, your management team, your employees, your friends, everybody's going to say, Mark, it's $1 billion. Take the money. You know, you'll be worth $650 million. You're 22. You can change the world. Your venture capitalist is going to tell you, Mark, I'll back your next company. It'll be even better than Facebook. And I said, dude, look, this is your call. But if that ever happens, I hope that you say no, because I think you have a chance to build not only the next big thing, but a company that's really good, that you've solved this social issue for networks that I think is profoundly important. So I've just laid this really heavy trip on him, right? It takes about 2 minutes to tell him this. And I'm expecting some kind of feedback. What happens instead is I get dead silence. Now, this is radio. Anybody who's ever heard, say, 10 seconds of dead air on radio knows that silence in certain circumstances is really painful.
It's the cardinal sin of radio.
Okay, so imagine this is the equivalent of radio. I'm 3 feet from this guy. I've laid this trip on him. And instead of saying anything, he's pantomiming thinker poses. So, you know, hand on forehead, hand, you know, chin on hand, you know, chin on both hands. At the 1 minute mark, I'm still telling myself, wow, he's like showing great respect, right? He's really thinking about what I said. This is really cool. At the 2 minute mark, I'm going, nope, this is just weird. At 3 minutes, my fingernails have dug trenches in the upholstery. At 4 minutes, I'm literally ready to scream. And sometime in the fifth minute, he finally relaxes and he goes, you won't believe this, but the reason I'm here is that the thing you just described just happened. That is what I wanted to talk to you about. Somebody offered $1 billion exactly as you described it. Everybody did exactly what you said.
And that was Yahoo at the time.
It was Yahoo. And I said, well, do you want to sell the company? He said, no, but I don't want to disappoint everybody. I said, that's not the issue. The question is, do you want to sell? And he said, no, I don't want to sell. And so I helped him figure out how to explain to everybody else why he wasn't going to sell. Because the pressure on him was so intense, he was going to fold. And he didn't want to. And so I helped him figure out how to do it. The whole meeting lasted maybe half an hour. But that was the beginning. After that, he called me up right away. I went over to his office maybe a day or two later. And I probably went almost every week and sometimes more than once a week for the next 3 years. We had an amazing relationship. And the thing I would say, everybody has an image of what Mark's like. You know, maybe you've seen the movie The Social Network. Maybe you've watched all the news lately. The Mark I knew was like neither one of those. The Mark I knew was only in a business context. I mean, I was 50, he was 22. We were not going to go socializing together. We were not interested in the same kind of music. And actually, I never even found out what kind of music
I was wondering.
No, I have no
was
idea.
Was it rap? Was
I
it
have
punk?
No idea. Okay. I have absolutely no idea what he was into. I still don't know. And it didn't matter, right? I wasn't looking for that, right? I just wanted to help this really interesting young entrepreneur. I wasn't even an investor. I was just trying to help him out. And he eventually gave me a chance to invest. But the problem that he had was that his whole management team wanted to sell the company. Well, if they were going to go ahead with it, it didn't make any sense to keep those people because they didn't have the right time horizon. So he needed to change out people. And the core position he needed to change out was his number two, the chief operating officer. And so I encouraged him to hire Sheryl Sandberg. I had gotten to know Sheryl because she introduced me to Bono. In 1998 and 99, Sheryl and Bono worked on a project when she was the chief of staff to the Secretary of the Treasury. And the project was to forgive debt for all these little countries around the world who'd gotten way underwater, were never going to be able to pay the debt back. And their economies could never get restarted because they were under this burden that they couldn't fix. And Bono and Sheryl figured out how to persuade the US, the UK, Germany, France, and all these other big countries to forgive tens of billions of dollars of that debt, which gave these countries a chance to start over. It was one of the great humanitarian gestures of our lifetime. And Sheryl did this with Bono. And it was really weird. At that time, I was working with the Grateful Dead. They had called me up one day in 1998, towards the end of that year, and they said, "Hey, we hear you're a deadhead." And I went, "Well, that's true."
Just out of the blue, you got a call from?
Yeah, I get this call from a guy who's like a real estate developer. Uh-huh. He wants to create a project in San Francisco called Terrapin Station. And they got an entire city block on right near the waterfront of San Francisco. And the guy wanted to do this Grateful Dead themed development with an office tower and an apartment building and a shopping mall.
I'm a big deadhead and I remember that.
And it was going to have the vault in it, and it was going to have like a performing arts theater. And the key thing for Bobby Weir was it was going to have a roller coaster. And so they called me up, this guy calls me up. He says, "We want your help on analyzing this thing and pitching it to the band." I go, "Look, I don't know anybody in the Grateful Dead. I'm a front of house fan. I've never been backstage. I don't know any of them." I said, "But if they call me, maybe I'll get involved." So they call me. And I explained to Bobby and Phil and Mickey and everybody else who was there.
The
other people who were involved. Peter McQuaid from Grateful Dead Productions and the other members there. Hal Canada was the lawyer. I said, "Guys, I don't know anything about real estate. I mean, I'm willing to look at this thing with you, but realistically, I can't help you. I'm going, the one thing I look at Bobby, I go, Bobby, the one thing I can promise you is by the time they build this thing, there will not be a roller coaster. You know, that the math just won't support it, right? I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful idea, but that's in there to get your approval. And then when it's too late for you to back out, then that'll go away, and probably the performing arts theater will go away too. And it will be an office tower and an apartment complex and a shopping mall. And yes, you'll have the vault there, but maybe not anything else." But I said, "I'm not really the one to do that. But, you know, I know a lot about tech, and you've got this thing called Dead.net that one of your roadies has created, and you're selling, you know, T-shirts and the early Dick's Picks CDs to fans." I said, "I think there's a really great idea where we could upgrade the technology to modern stuff and then syndicate it to all the other bands and let them do what the Dead does of selling directly to their fans." Well, everybody loved that idea. And so Peter McQuaid and I went around to Dave Matthews Band and Fish and Pearl Jam and Jackson Brown and Bob Dylan, all these other bands. And we're getting them all circled up. And everybody was really into it. We're looking to get a little bit of financing to back it up. And Bono hears about this idea. And, you know, he's working with Sheryl on Forgiving the Debt. And he goes, "Sheryl, can you find out who this guy is? And she says, I don't know him, but I know exactly who he is because my brother-in-law works for him, and he's working on the Grateful Dead project. And so without actually knowing me, Cheryl introduced Bono to me. And so then you roll the thing forward to 2007. I introduced Cheryl to Mark. I mean, they'd met once in passing, but
she was at Google at the time.
She was at Google, which is something. When she left Washington, she came and hung out in my office for a few weeks, and we introduced her to the people who hired her at Google. And
there was a pretty big product she was responsible for.
Oh, no. I mean, to be clear, when she went to work at Google, they were just a search engine. They didn't really have a business yet. And Cheryl was one of three women put in charge of creating what was called AdWords, which was the advertising product that was tied to search. So if you searched for a hammer, you'd get on the side of the page three ads for people who want to sell you a hammer. It was one of the greatest advertising products ever created because it was super honest, especially in the early days. And everybody got what they wanted, which you got, you found the hammer, the guy sold the hammer, Google got paid a little bit for the ad. Cheryl built the sales force and scaled that product up, and I thought she was the best person Mark was going to be able to get. And so my role at Facebook was limited because it was 3 years, 2006 to 2009. And if you think about it, by the time I was done, they didn't really have a business model yet. And so all the things that freaked me out later on hadn't happened yet. And I will say this because I'm a professional analyst and I've spent my whole life studying tech companies. There were a few moments along the way that things happened that I saw that were really important clues to the problems to come. And I didn't make the proper connections.
Can you name one clue?
I'll give you a couple of them. In 2006, I think it was 2006, they introduced a product called Beacon. And what Beacon was this was one of their first efforts to have advertising. So they would go to retailers and they'd go, look, if somebody who's a member of Facebook buys a product from you, we will post the transaction on Facebook to their account and share it with everybody, and that'll justify you advertising because, effectively you'll pay us to do that, right? And that'll get people to know that one of their friends bought from you, and then they'll come and buy from you also. Well, practically the first day, a man bought a diamond engagement ring from Overstock.com at a deep, deep discount, and it got posted to his Facebook newsfeed without his knowledge. And his fiancée-to-be and all of his friends saw a picture of the ring, the price point and source, before he'd had a chance to tell anybody going to propose.
So the whole idea was getting information on Facebook customers from external sites.
Well, what was terrifying about it was that you were posting it. I mean, it's bad enough if you were getting the information. Uh-huh. It's way worse if you're
exposing it
without their permission, uh-huh. Right? Anyway, the blowback was staggering, and they pulled the product almost immediately. And my assumption was that they had learned a lesson. Passage of time suggests they didn't learn the lesson I hoped they would learn. In 2011, I was at the TED conference, and the guy who was the head of MoveOn.org gave a short TED talk, which is still up.
His name Eli Pariser.
Eli Pariser. Yes. And I would encourage you to go look at it. It was about filter bubbles. And basically, Eli had noticed that his newsfeed, whether it was on Facebook or Google, had changed. That he had roughly equal number of friends on the left and right, but he read more of the stuff from the people on the left than he did on the right. And as a consequence, over time, the posts from the people on the left crowded out posts from the people on the right, and so he was no longer getting a balanced feed. And he said no one had asked his permission to do this, no one had told him this was going on, but quite obviously neither product was neutral any longer, and he thought that there were really huge policy implications from this. So I heard him give this thing. I was blown away. And I went down, introduced myself right away, and we had a long chat. And we've been friends ever since. I mean, but I didn't stick with it. I didn't think through the implications of that because that's right before the time that Facebook really starts to create a business model. So what winds up happening is that I conclude shortly thereafter that I really am not suited to being an investor anymore. In 2007, I had a chance to be one of the two first investors in Zynga, the guys who did Farmville.
Oh, yes.
And I had this meeting with the founder, and it was really obvious it was going to be a huge hit, but it was also equally obvious that he and I had really different value systems, and it was just not going to work.
So this is where Silicon Valley values started changing, right?
Well, yeah, they started changing in front of that, but that was when it became really obvious to
me.
And then Spotify comes along, and Mark Zuckerberg says, I want to introduce you. I think you and Bono should lead this investment. And Spotify's first deal, they do this deal with, I think it was Sony. And it was like a $45 million deal. And they gave $42 million of it. They classified it as research and development so that none of it got paid to the artists. Like $3 million goes to the artists and like $42 million goes to the label. And I go, I'm sorry, I'm a musician. Bono's a musician. We cannot be supporting that kind of mistreatment of artists. And, you know, I'm sure the people at Spotify are very nice, but I just thought that that model was wrong. And then a couple of years later, around 2011, Uber comes along, and it's like, I mean, it may be a little slightly later than that, but Uber comes along, and, you know, they're basically flipping a bird to the local government in the city where they live, San Francisco, and they were really taking advantage of the drivers. And I just go, you know, I just can't do this anymore, that I'm turning down things I know are going to be successful investments because philosophically I'm just not aligned. And I can't manage other people's money if I'm not going to put it behind the things they're going to do best. And so I make the decision I'm not going to, as soon as Elevation's done, I'm going to be done. And that comes at the end of 2015. And in January 2016, my wife and I are on a well-deserved vacation. I'm on Facebook because, let's face it, I'm addicted. And so I'm on there, and all of a sudden I see these images with text, what they call on the internet, memes, coming from Facebook groups that claim affiliation to the Bernie Sanders campaign. But the memes themselves are really misogynistic, vicious depictions of Hillary Clinton. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's really weird. Why would Bernie allow his name to get put on, you know? I mean, no matter how he feels about Clinton, you know, it's terrible to do stuff that's so obviously, you know, it shows that kind of gender insensitivity. Next day, there's like four people sharing. So first day, it's like one person. Second day, it's like four people. And then it's like eight people and then more than that. And I realized, whoa, that's not normal. I mean, things don't spread that way. Somebody's spending money to get my friends into these groups. And I'm thinking, that's weird. Why would they do that? I mean, all it's doing is spreading misogynistic anti-Hillary memes for a guy who at that point wasn't necessarily going to be a big candidate. Then a couple of months later, Facebook expels a corporation that was using its advertising tools to gather data on people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter. And they were selling that data, the identities of these people, to police departments who would then presumably go and harass the people. Now, Facebook did the right thing. They expelled the people. But the problem was they didn't expel them until after the harm had been done. I'm thinking, wow, I mean, that's a massive violation of civil rights. A couple months later, the United Kingdom has its referendum on leaving the European Union, Brexit. And there, that's the first time I realized. So the outcome was a huge surprise, a giant swing. You know, the polls the night before the referendum suggest that they're going to remain in the EU by a pretty decent margin. And the margin is flipped. So they vote to leave by a pretty big margin. And that shock, the only thing I could think of that would explain it was the fact that the Leave campaign, its advertising on Facebook had been this incendiary anti-immigrant stuff that, you know, really triggered fear and outrage in people. Whereas the Remain campaign was going, hey, we got the best deal in the EU. Don't rock the boat. You know, totally neutral. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what if it's true that Facebook gives an advantage to inflammatory negative messages in a political sense? That's like bad for democracy. And then in August, we find out about Manafort, and I'm starting to freak out, okay? And in October, I'm starting to write an op-ed about this because I'm really worried and I want to call attention to the problem. And the Department of Housing and Urban Development cites Facebook for advertising tools that allow discrimination in violation of the Fair Housing Law. Same week, the intelligence agencies say the Russians are trying to interfere in the election, and I basically go, I got to send this op-ed. Instead of publishing, I'm going to send it to Mark and Cheryl. My wife says, I really think you should send it to them. I agreed, so that's what I did.
And you hadn't talked to them in many years at this point.
Well, no. I mean, I talked to Cheryl, and I traded emails with Mark. But I hadn't been a mentor at that point, you know, for 7 years.
Okay.
And, you know, I still considered myself a friend. And so I was reaching out to my friends because I thought they were the victim. And I mean, I think they've made bad choices, but they were sort of well-intended bad choices. And so they were really quite dismissive. They basically say, look, Roger, we've taken care of all these things. It's not systemic. Because my argument was there was something wrong with the business model and the algorithms. So something systemic. And that it was allowing bad actors to hurt innocent people. And their counter argument was, no, Roger, it's all isolated and we've taken care of it. But, you know, you're an old friend, so we're going to have one of Mark's chief lieutenants work with you and see if there's anything here. They hand me off to a guy named Dan Rose, who was a good friend of mine and a guy I really respected. So while it wasn't perfect, it was, you know, better than nothing. And so we're having this conversation. Dan's going, look, Roger, even if these things you're talking about are true, it wouldn't matter because we're protected by the law. And I'm going, oh, come on now. He goes, yeah. No, the law says we're a platform, not a media company. So we're not responsible for what third parties do. And I'm like pulling my hair out. And we talk about this for 2 or 3 days. Then the election happens, right? Because I reached out to Mark and Cheryl on the 30th of October, so 9 days before the election. So these conversations are all happening before the election. It's not even occurring to me that Facebook's going to have an impact on the election. I mean, again, failure of analysis. So the election happens. I call Dan the next morning. I go, and you just have to imagine F-bombs roughly every third word in the following sentence. The blank Russians have tipped the blank election using blank Facebook. At the end of the day, he's going, no, but we're cool. No problem. We're protected by the law. We're a platform. And I'm going, dude, you don't get it. You're a trust business. You know, people's lives don't depend on this. They can leave you. If they conclude you're responsible for civil rights violations or undermining democracy, you are doomed. You got to do what Johnson & Johnson did in 1982 after that guy put poison in bottles of Tylenol. You have got to spring to the defense of the people who use your product. You've got to help, you know, investigators get to the bottom of this. You're going to take a hit in the short run, but you're going to build trust, and that's the only hope for you. If you don't do that, you're risking the whole business. So Dan and I have this conversation for 3 months. I don't say a word on the outside because I'm convinced if I go public with it, they'll never talk to me again. So I just want to persuade him. But I realize he's not moving at all. And he asks for more evidence. I give him more evidence. It's like nothing is good enough. And so finally I give up. I go, I got to decide what I'm going to do. I'm retired. I could just sit back and let somebody else deal with it. But it kept nagging at me. It was like, I had been part of this thing on the way up. I'd helped Mark. I'd brought Cheryl in. I mean, not all by myself, but I'd helped bring Cheryl in. And I'd profited from it. If I wasn't willing to stand up and try to fix this problem, what was I going to ever stand up for, right? And so it just snapped in me that I had to do this. That I had to become an activist. And I didn't even know what that meant. So I went looking for allies. And the first one, bless his heart, was T-Bone Burnett, the producer. Oh,
yes.
So T-Bone and I had worked at Elevation really closely. I had a project to try to help musicians get their intellectual property back. And, you know, the hippie in me always coming through, right? and so I knew T-Bone really well. And T-Bone had this friend, Jonathan Taplin. Jonathan in those days was a professor at USC, but John's claim to fame was he was going to Princeton and he got a summer job as the road manager for what was then a new band called The Band. And so he's the road manager for the band, which he then parlays into being the road manager also for Bob Dylan. And, you know, I mean, we're talking all the way through the last waltz, right? And he then goes to Hollywood. And he's there like for an hour, and he meets this young guy with a script he's looking to sell named Francis Ford Coppola.
Wow.
So by the time John's 30 years old, he's conquered rock and roll and Hollywood.
And movies, yes.
And so you can just imagine that John is like one of these people who, you know, he's used to being successful. Right? And so John didn't have a lot of patience for me, but he was writing a book called Move Fast and Break Things that was about Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
That was the Facebook motto when they started, right?
Correct. And the book was really about how these internet monopolies were undermining the arts, but also democracy. And he gave me a pre-production version of the book, and I went, oh, my God. I'm thinking about this just as an issue of democracy. He's adding in the economic piece of it. And I finished reading the book, and I happened to be co-hosting one day on the technology TV show on Bloomberg TV. And there's a guy on there who had been at Google. He'd been a design ethicist there. And
Tristan Harris.
And so Tristan's claim to fame was that he had been trained at Stanford in persuasive technology.
I want to ask you about that. It was fascinating.
So he goes to Google, right? And he's at Google, and all of a sudden a lightning bolt hits him. That basically software companies are using persuasive technology to create habits that turn into addictions, which make people vulnerable to manipulation. And so he writes what becomes a legendary slide deck that goes viral inside Google. And Google, you know, Tristan's explanation of this is different from mine. Tristan goes, well, the Google guys rewarded me by letting me pick my job, and I picked a job in New York. And I think what happened was that Google was terrified, and they basically said, you know, you can go anywhere. He just can't stay here. And so he goes to New York, where he immediately disappears, and Google never has to worry about him again. But he got himself on 60 Minutes. And it happened that Bloomberg had signed him up for an interview. And I happened to be co-hosting that day, so they asked me to do the interview. So I'm reading the transcript of 60 Minutes, and the light bulb goes off. He's explaining in this thing that, yeah, you know, the problem with these internet platforms is they got to get you to come back. How do they do that? Well, they use these tricks of psychology, like rewards. But they do it the same way slot machines work. The rewards come at unexpected times. So they use notifications and likes and things like that to get you to build a habit that then, for many people, turns into an addiction.
And he got this from a professor at Stanford.
B.J. Fogg. But he got it from more than that. I mean,
okay.
He'd been a magician before that. And all the same things work in magic. But the tech guys has some advantages because they had the ability to identify people as individuals. Right? Filter bubbles and all had existed back in television. When I was a kid, when you were a kid, we all saw the Kennedy funeral. We saw the Beatles come to America on Ed Sullivan. We saw the Apollo moon landing. You know, we saw everything right up through the MASH finale. And the filter bubble of that time created a problem of conformity because we all had the same facts. We all saw the same things at the same time, and everybody basically believed the same things. And the difference with the internet was it allowed you to have a different set of facts for every person. That essentially, once you got people coming back, then you needed to get them to spend a lot of time. And what they discovered was if you showed them happy stuff all the time, one person's happiness is another person's jealousy. But one person's fear or outrage becomes contagious. And so it basically, you share things that make you afraid or outraged because you develop comfort when others share those emotions.
That was one of the things that amazed me about the book. They have that angry button in Facebook now. And from Fogg's book, and I guess from Harris, it was proven that it's easier to influence people who are angry, and they're also more likely to share content.
Right. So you wind up in this situation where they have the ability to target each and every one of us separately. They identify the things that motivate us. They find our emotional triggers, and they hit those over and over again. But they don't hit the happiness ones nearly as often as they hit the fear and outrage ones. They also discover that disinformation and conspiracy theories are really popular, right? That disinformation spreads 70% further, 6 times faster than fact. And there's something about the wiring of human beings that makes all of this true. And so it's in our most basic evolutionary wiring. And so these guys play to this, and the effect of it is if you're Facebook, you're at 2.5 billion users and 2.5 billion different Truman shows. Everybody has their, you know, everybody has their own set of facts. And if you're thinking about this in the context of democracy, which is the way I was looking at the problem, Well, no wonder we were so polarized, right? Because the natural tendency of these products is to isolate you in this self-reinforcing bubble of ideas that are all the same and gradually become more extreme. Because it turns out that if you get fed the same thing over and over again, your views become more rigid and more extreme over time. And that drives people apart. And so all of a sudden, the light bulb went off. I saw what I'd seen. I say, Tristan, I think you've got it. I think this issue of addiction, this issue of persuasive technology is the root cause of the problem I saw, and therefore the root cause of the problem that Taplin saw when he was talking about, you know, about the damage done by these internet monopolies. Do you need a wingman? I'd love to help you out. And so suddenly I found the guy I was going to work with. And we immediately set off to try to make something happen. And the first thing that comes along 2 weeks later is the TED conference, the headquarters of TED Talks, right? And it turns out that two people, Sam Harris, you know, the philosopher and podcaster, and Eli Pariser, I attempted to get the head guy at TED to sign up Tristan. Now, keep in mind, normally you get signed up 6 to 8 months ahead of time. This is 2 weeks ahead of time, and I was never going to get it done. But Sam Harris and Eli Pariser got it done. So Tristan gets invited. There's 1,000 people at this conference.
This is in Vancouver, BC.
In Vancouver, British Columbia. And we're thinking to ourselves, our mission is to get a conversation started. And we're obviously not the right people to carry it through to the promised land. But if we go to TED, there are all these like really powerful, really big branded people. And we'll just collect their business cards and hand it off to them. And we're thinking, we'll get 1,000 business cards. We'll be done in 2 weeks. So we get to the TED conference. And Tristan gives this impassioned pitch to polite applause. And afterwards, we're going around to collect business cards. And I swear we got like 2 cards. And I don't think either one of them returned a call. And so you wind up with this thing where we're going, we need a plan B. You know, we don't know anybody outside of tech. What are we going to do? And then another miracle occurs. The woman who had done Tristan's makeup on 60 Minutes, a woman named Brenda, her day job was doing makeup for Arianna Huffington. And she calls up Arianna and says, Arianna, I've worked for you for a decade. I've never told you you had to interview anybody. You've got to interview this guy. So we go to New York so he can meet Arianna Huffington. Meanwhile, Taplin, who wrote the book Move Fast and Break Things, sends me a card for a guy who worked for Senator Mark Warner from Virginia, who was the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Yes.
The only committee in Congress where the Republicans and the Democrats are talking to each other. So I call the guy up and I go, dude, who's going to protect the 2018 midterms from more interference on social media? And he goes, I don't know. I'm going, look, I know your mission is to deal with intelligence agencies. I know this isn't your beat, but you're the only committee that's functional. If you don't do it, nobody will. And he goes, you know, you're right. You got to see Warner. I'll get you in front of Warner. And then we have this scheduling snafu that was just a disaster. And it's July before we go to Washington. So we go to Washington and we can only get 3 meetings set up. It's like, this is going to be a long, slow climb. Meanwhile, though, Arianna Huffington's gone to work and gotten Tristan on Bill Maher and all these... like the Sam Harris podcast and other things, right? So, you know, he's starting to take off, which is all we're trying to do. We get to Washington. We start out with a woman who was one of, at that time, of only 2 commissioners of the Federal Trade Commission. There's supposed to be 5, and you can't function with fewer than 3, so it's literally morbid. And she's explaining to us what we got to do in order to, like, get antitrust law and all that to work for us. And then we go and have the most amazing meeting, really 2 in a row. The first one was with Senator Elizabeth Warren, and she'd asked to see us. Now, this is July of 2017.
How'd she get word? Well, through Mark Warner?
No, she got word through a group that was then called the Open Markets Division of a think tank called New America, now known as the Open Markets Institute. And those guys said, you know, these people are really good on tech, because she was really interested in applying antitrust law to tech. And so we go to this meeting thinking we're just going to meet with her chief of staff and her policy aide. But no, we're meeting with her as well as the other 2 people. And she explains, she goes, the way it looks to me is that tech is like the banking industry. In the banking industry in 2008, the problem was that the banks had perfect information. And the people who bought the products from him only had the information the banks were willing to give them. And that's not capitalism, right? That's more like extortion, right? Or theft. And she says, I think that's what's going on in tech. I facepalm myself. That was such a brilliant analysis, such a brilliant insight. I'm like, whoa, I'm in the presence of a really, really brilliant person. And she said, can you help us? And we're looking and going, damn right, we'll help. How, you know, just tell us what you need. And then we go see Warner. And Warner goes, so what do you think the deal is? And so Tristan explains his whole hypothesis. And then I give him 8 hypotheses about what must have happened in the 2016 election. And we don't have any data. All we have is I've read publicly available things and then done what an analyst does. I make connections. The most likely explanation is the simplest one. And the simplest one was that the Russians had been at this since 2014, maybe even 2013. They'd been focused on causing Americans to not trust democracy. So they focused on all these really inflammatory issues, you know, whether it was Black Lives Matter or guns or immigration. And they're often investing on both sides to get people to fight with each other. You know, we give them all these things, and Warner goes, oh, my God, who's on this? And we're explaining it's Google, it's Facebook, it's Twitter. And he's going, do we have any friends at all? And I go, oh, yeah, we got one. Yes, who's that? Well, I think Apple's our friend. And he calms down. He looked like he was white as a sheet. And he goes, no, okay, that's good. I like Tim Cook. He's a good guy. I'm going, yeah, I think Apple's really serious about this privacy thing. And he goes, well, what do we do? And then Tristan, in one of those moments where you say exactly the right thing at the exactly right time, he goes, oh, I think that's very easy. You need to subpoena, you need to have a hearing and subpoena Mark Zuckerberg and make him explain why he's not responsible for the outcome of the election. And Warner goes, that's a good idea. Now, I think they were thinking about doing a hearing, but I don't think they were thinking about doing a hearing about the internet companies, right? Mm-hmm. And so Tristan had an impact on that. So we go away, and then immediately the 8 hypotheses I gave him, like 7 of them get validated in the press within a month.
What month was this now?
Or? So this is between middle of July and middle of August of 2017.
Oh, okay, because I've got a stat here from September 2017.
Yeah, so we're not to that yet.
Okay.
So in that month, all these things come true, and suddenly they think we're Nostradamus, right? I mean, it's like we've got this magic 8-ball. We've come up with 7 things in a row.
Right.
So they call us back and they go, you guys got to come back here. And they say, hint, hint, we're going to do a hearing and we need to introduce you to a bunch of people. And so the two of us go back and we bring with us a woman named Renee DiResta, who is, I mean, a god. Renee is a computer scientist who began her career in what they call technical operations in the government, which is a euphemism you can decide for yourself what that means. And then she goes to Wall Street and she does like algorithmic trading. And she comes out to California and goes to work on behalf of the government because California tried to pass a law requiring vaccination. And so she infiltrates all the anti-vax groups online and figures out what they're doing. And she got doxxed on Twitter, which means all of her personal information got exposed and people were harassing her. And, you know, it was unbelievable. But they won. They got the thing passed. And she became an expert on how conspiracy theories spread on the internet. And so she goes to work in this thing called Data for Democracy, helping to protect democracy from hacking. And so she'd been one of the first people to see the Russian interference. So the three of us go to Washington. And on the first day we're there, we have this 15-minute meeting with Adam Schiff, who is the head of the Democratic head of the House Intelligence Committee. And he says, so what's your story? And I give him the short form of our thing. And he goes, what are you doing at noon tomorrow? We go, oh, we got a meeting. He goes, okay, I need Roger, you and Renee, I need you to meet me in the Rayburn Room in the Capitol. The Rayburn Room is like the room where the Democrats would bring their guests from outside. So if you want to have an informal meeting in the Capitol, that's where you did it. So it's like a club room. And, you know, there's a few tables and chairs, but it's basically a big open space and you can go there. But it's a pretty cool place to go. And it was right outside Nancy Pelosi's office. And so we go and meet him. And he's only got 15 minutes. And he goes, so this is really important. What are you doing at 3 o'clock today? And we go, oh, we got another meeting. He goes, I need you guys to go to this bunker under the Capitol. I'm going, really? He goes, yeah, you're going to meet the committee. So if you've ever watched Adam when he comes out of those committee meetings that are underground. There's this room with a red plaque on the door. And there have been pictures. You've seen all the witnesses coming out of there, right? And it's way underground.
That's why he calls it the bunker.
Well, no, we called it the bunker. Oh, okay. No, they call it the skiff, but we called it the bunker because it was so far underground. And it's one of these really, really secure places. And, you know, you have to turn in your phones before you go inside and all that. And we didn't go to the inner sanctum. We were in the outer inner sanctum, but that was good enough for us. And we meet with these two people, one of whom is the lead attorney for the committee and the other is the lead investigator. And the lead attorney looks at me and he's very stern. He goes, "What's your story?" I said, "Well, we just have some hypotheses and this is what we think happened." He pauses for a moment. He goes, "We think your hypotheses are valid."
Ah.
It was like a dramatic pause, thank God, for that. And then it turns out that the woman had been, shall we say, in technical operations for the government, before she went to the committee.
Renee.
So she and the lead investigator. She and Renee have this thing in common.
Oh, okay.
So at which point it's like, you know, it's like the Group W bench in Alice's restaurant. Yeah, we all come back together, we're smoking cigarettes, you know, sitting there on the Group W bench, right? It's like after he explains that, you know, he's there for creating a nuisance. And so all of a sudden we're palsy. And so we have this really and what winds up happening is they ask us to prepare them for these hearings, which are 7 weeks away. Would we train them in the inner workings of how Facebook and Twitter work? So Renee took Twitter, I took Facebook, and we teach them what they need to know. And it was immensely satisfying because they were great students. I mean, they're really smart people, but because of the line of work they were in, they couldn't be as embedded in these products as we were. And so, you know, they wanted to understand. Well, they knew what an algorithm was, but how does it work inside Facebook? And, you know, exactly on Twitter, if you were trying to put a piece of disinformation in, how would you do it, right? That kind of stuff. And so we wind up writing up lists of questions for the various members to ask, and not just in the House, but also in the Senate. And so they have these hearings on October 31st of 2017 and November 1st. And we watch, you know, and maybe every third or fourth question is one that we've given them. And, you know, so we're really – and then they get to the House thing, and it's pretty much every question is one we gave them. And so we're feeling really good. And we think we're done because now the things – everybody's talking about. And I'm talking to Adam Schiff a few days later, and I'm going, well, I guess we're – you know, because Tristan says to me, wow, 7 months. I think we're done. We, you know, we can go home now. And Adam Schiff goes, what are you talking about, done? It's just the first inning, you know? Now you got to – he said, there's nobody but you guys. You got to keep going. So that's what happened. And so the thing is – and, Ken, this is the really important part – is that this book – I wrote the book really as Jimmy Stewart in the movie Rear Window, you know, where I see what looks like a crime scene. But I have no idea what I've seen, and I really don't understand what it's about. And I say, shame on me. I'm an analyst. I should have known, but I didn't. And so I pull on the thread, and I use my journey of discovery to teach the reader everything they need to know. And you don't need to know anything about technology. There's no technical babble in this thing. The whole thing is designed for normal people who really don't care about tech to understand how this stuff works, what the games are that they're playing on you. You know, why these business models are so dangerous. That it, the issue here is that the incentives are to manipulate your attention with rewards, with things like likes, but also to bombard you with things that hit your emotional hot buttons. So particularly things that are anxiety producing, outrage, fear, and the like. And naturally, that's going to cause huge issues in democracy. But it's also going to cause huge issues in public health. And you see this with products like Instagram on teenagers, right? Particularly preteen girls with body shaming and other forms of bullying. And then with older teens, you see fear of missing out. With adults, you see filter bubbles and all the obvious consequences there. And with really little kids, you've got YouTube and all the horrible things that happen on YouTube and with Chromebooks where, you know, a kid in a classroom is handed a Chromebook and no wonder they can't concentrate, right? They're there to learn to concentrate on the teacher and to learn to socialize with their classmates, but they've got this screen in front of them and they've got Fortnite playing on it. It's kind of hard to concentrate. And so these guys are basically profiting from undermining society. And then there are all the issues of privacy. And people say to me, Roger, my data's out there. You know, I'm a good guy. I got nothing to worry about. And I go, you know what? Those can both be true and irrelevant at the same time. Because what we're dealing with here is, whether you realize it or not, we're all losing the ability to make choices without fear. And that's the real definition of privacy, because these people are watching everything. So let me give you the example. And I didn't know this at the time, but I've discovered this since. In 2002, Google just had a search engine. And it was a pretty traditional company. It gathered data from the people who used the search engine in order to make the search engine better for the people who used it. But they discovered they only needed a tiny percentage of the data they gathered to make the search engine better. So what did they do? They analyzed the rest of the data and discovered, wow, it actually has value for predicting behavior. And they thought to themselves, what other kinds of data could we gather? Would that make our behavioral predictions more valuable? So they started with saying, a search engine tells you what people intend to buy, because when they're going to buy something, they look it up. But we don't know who they are. So let's create email. We'll create Gmail as a product. And then they did something incredibly cynical. They basically said, well, if we want to know people's intentions, if we want to predict their behavior, why don't we read their emails? Because they're going to tell us in the emails. And then they did something maximally cynical. They put ads in the beginning, knowing that people would protest against the ads. And that when they took the ads away, people would think the problem went away. But Google was still scanning their emails for behavioral signals, right? And then they go, well, we don't know where the people are, so they create Google Maps, right? And then they realize, wait a minute, there's all this data out there that's unclaimed. So they start driving cars up and down the streets, taking pictures of our homes and saying, we own this. And that wasn't enough, so they do satellite view, right? So they do street view, then satellite view, then they do Google Glass because they want to get right up in your grill. And people hated Google Glass, so the guy leaves and starts Niantic. And you go, well, why is that relevant? Well, they created Pokemon Go using all the Google APIs.
Oh, so augmented reality.
And so that's all about capturing video up close of all these public spaces, right? So you're sitting there going, and then they go, well, that's not enough. Why don't we go and buy all the data? So they go out and buy all of our credit card transaction data from companies that are the processors. So that's, you know, Equifax and Experian and TransUnion. They go to cellular companies and get all the geographic location data. They go to health and wellness apps and buy, you know, your heart rate and all that kind of stuff.
And all that private information is for sale?
It's all for sale.
Oh, okay.
And then they go and they, of course, get browsing histories either by planting trackers in you or buying browsing histories from other places.
Right.
And meanwhile, they're also collecting data on children. And they don't ask permission. They just do it. And nobody says no. So the way to think about this is that Google initially, followed by Facebook, and now more recently followed by Amazon and Microsoft, and then you got the wannabes, which are kind of like Verizon and Comcast, people like that. They're creating a digital avatar, really a data avatar for each one of us, with all the data that represents who we are. The difference is, though, that we don't control that avatar. They do. And their goal initially was just to have better ad targeting. Right? So they say, we're going to give you a service, and then we'll target ads at you.
They just want to sell you something.
Right?
But then, are they doing now?
And then they wake up and they go, well, wait a minute, we can do better than that. We can actually steer people towards desired outcomes using the technology we have. So that's where filter bubbles come in, right? They tell you, oh, we're just giving you what we want. Or sorry, what you want. But what they're really doing is giving us what they want, right? So they're steering us to desired outcomes in order to make the behavioral predictions that they're selling to marketers more valuable. And then they go, oh, we're going to make recommendation engines. If you liked X, Y, and Z, you're for sure going to write
Which
alpha,
Amazon
beta.
Uses quite a bit.
Well, everybody uses it, right? And you think to yourself, well, you know, they got to be kind of close. Yes, but within a range of things, they're going to pick the things that are best for them, right? And all of this is about behavioral manipulation. Now, you ask yourself, well, what's coming next? And you go, well, after behavioral manipulation comes what I would describe as perfect information. This is the marketplace where they know something that you don't know, and they can sell that to somebody to whom it's really valuable. And here's the example. Have you ever gone on one of those sites, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times are among them, but they say we need to see if you're a robot or a human, so
you need
to identify these pictures, right? Pick out the pictures with a bus or the street sign or streetlight.
Yes.
And you think to yourself, well, they're just figuring it out if I'm a human. Well, that's not what's going on at all. So they're totally not telling you the truth. What they're really doing is you are being asked to identify those things, buses, street signs, streetlights, cars, in order to train the artificial intelligence for Google self-driving cars. That's why these things have gotten so much harder in the last year, because the easy things are all done. Now they're trying to find out.
You know, I never realized that.
Now, nobody realized this. You know how they find out you're a human?
No.
Your mouse movement. Now, imagine, which I think is true, that they are capturing a file of your mouse movements over time.
Uh-huh.
So imagine the very first day. So your mouse movements are probably pretty consistent. Then one day they slow down and get more erratic. It may be the first symptom of Parkinson's or some other neurologic disorder.
And they can pick up on that.
Now, are they going to tell you? Well, they're under zero obligation to tell you. They're also under zero obligation to keep it secret. In fact, all the economic incentives for them are to sell it to the highest bidder, who will almost certainly be your health insurance company, which will almost certainly either raise your rates or cut off your insurance, and you still do not know you have a symptom. And here's what's sad. Obviously, that same functionality could be used to create an insurance product where they said to you, you know, pay us a buck a month or a buck a year, and if you ever have a neurologic disorder, we'll give you the first indication. It won't be a sure thing that you have it, right? But it'll say, go see your neurologist because maybe you do. And right? I mean, they could easily do this for you. But in their model, you know, they say in traditional advertising that the consumer isn't the customer. The consumer is the product, right, in an advertising model. But in the Google Facebook model, we're actually the fuel. We're like this reservoir of data that they monetize. So it doesn't occur to them to sell that to us or to help us or to tell us or even...
Oh, I was searching for a quote here from somebody you admire quite a bit, so Shana Zuboff. She said, the usual is if you're not paying for it, you're the product. She said, you are not the product. You are the abandoned carcass.
Yeah, again, I think you're the fuel, okay? Uh-huh. And I think you're left as an abandoned carcass. So Shoshana Zuboff wrote a book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which I think is it's a tour de force. Now, it's also a doorstop. It's huge. But it's really worth it. It's an extraordinary piece of economic research. And what I've just described to you, that whole Google thing that I just described, is essentially stuff derived from her work. I have hypothesized all of this in my book, but I didn't have data. She has all the data. So I tell you in 3 pages what she tells you in 300. So it may be a little simpler to read it in my book, but but her work is really extraordinary.
So, Roger, we've gone over quite a few frightening details here, including
yeah,
the
so Google
now
we need
tracking.
To talk about why we're going to win, okay? Can we spend a few minutes
yes, please leave us with
yeah,
a happy...
No. I mean, so here's the thing. The thing I just described to you is so obviously wrong.
Yes.
Right? That, well, guess what? They've overplayed their hand, right? Now, the incredible thing was Google kept this in the dark for 16 years, but Facebook was so clumsy, Cambridge Analytica and all this other stuff, that we found out, right? And then Zuboff wrote her book. So here's the thing. We have two angles of attack, and one involves every single one of us. And we can win this one in a walk. We have an election coming up in 2020. This is an issue of right versus wrong, not right versus left, and I'll walk you through it. Every politician you meet, you ask this question. Why is it legal for a provider of email or online applications, so Google or Microsoft, to scan your documents, your private documents, for data that they can monetize? Why is that legal? Why is it legal for your credit card processing company, which has no direct relationship with you, to sell your credit card transaction data to anybody who wants to buy it? Why is it legal for a company with a health or wellness app to sell your private health data to somebody who wants to buy it? Why is it legal for your cellular company or Uber or anybody else to sell location data? Why is it legal to even collect data about minors? I mean, we've never had a debate about this. These companies simply said, we're going to do this. And they challenged us to say no. And initially we didn't, but now we're going to. And I think you sit down with every politician who's running for president, who's running for the House, the Senate, city council, state legislature, and you insist. Because the truth is, we should ban all of these practices. There should be no third-party marketplace in our personal data. You know, I think we ban all third-party actions, and then we can have a reasonable conversation about which things you want to add back. But I think very few of them are going to get added back. I mean, when you want to use an Uber, of course Uber needs your location. But why should Uber be allowed to then give it to Google? And why should Google be allowed to do anything with it at all? Right? I mean, of course they should not.
So right now that's a gray area, though, right?
No, it's not gray at all. They're just doing it.
And it is perfectly legal. You couldn't prosecute
them. No. It has never been contested, which is
okay.
A different thing.
Okay.
There's no law that says they can do that. And there's nothing contractual that that really protects them. They've asserted this stuff.
Like
and
a EULA?
Some of your terms of service say that you're agreeing to it. But the terms of service are not, shall we say, entered into with either good information or a balanced power relationship, right? Because if you've been in Facebook for 10 years and they put this into their user license agreement, there is nothing you can do short of giving up 10 years investment in the platform if you disagree. And that's just not a fair deal. That's a Me Too style power relationship and should not be allowed. And so my point is Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Amazon have profited enormously from the lack of rules here. And I don't think they should be allowed to profit any longer from that. And we have that power and we should exercise it. And the second thing we want to do is we want to use antitrust law to create space for alternative business models to develop. Right now, especially Google, Facebook, and Amazon are choking off competitors that want to come up around them.
Would you recommend breaking them up then?
Well, breaking them up is one of the solutions. What I really want to do is I want to follow Elizabeth Warren's model, and which is Senator Klobuchar is also supporting, which is this notion that if you make a market the way that Amazon does with the marketplace, the way that Google and Facebook do in advertising, the way Microsoft does in advertising, you can't both make the market and participate in it because you're giving yourself too many advantages. You also can't subsidize businesses from your old businesses if you're a monopolist. You can't share data between these businesses if you're a monopolist. And you for sure can't do what these guys are doing in artificial intelligence, which is to essentially buy up every artificial intelligence person in the world and put them to work on behavioral modification. You know, they say to us, oh, you can't regulate us because the U.S. has to compete with China in AI. And I'm going, wait a minute, the Chinese effort in AI is behavioral modification to control their entire population in an authoritarian regime. In what world do we even care about that? Why would we want to even go there? And that is what Google and Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft are doing. They're doing behavioral modification. And my attitude is they shouldn't be allowed to do that. This is America, right? That's totally un-American. And, you know, I'm not only not interested in competing with China on that thing, I don't want anybody doing it here. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think we should be using AI as the technology penicillin of the 21st century, and we should be diagnosing people if they have a tremor that might be a neurological problem and letting them know, getting them to a doctor when it's cheap to fix it, right? And, you know, so all of these things are going on, and the solution is political. It's to raise our voice. We have way more power than we realize. And the problem is among the presidential candidates, there's a really wide range, right? So weirdly, and this is an amazing thing about this. My book came out February 5th. I've been on MSNBC or CNBC, I think, 8 times since it came out. I've been on Fox or Fox Business 8 times since it came out. This plays on both sides because there's like 1 million people who work at those companies and like 339 million of us who don't, right? So this is really not right versus left. It's really right versus wrong. And importantly, I'm working with the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. I'm working with the FTC on this stuff. I mean, there was no antitrust regulation under either Obama or Bush. But weirdly, there may be some under Trump, and that would be a great thing. And what I'm saying here on all of this is that in this country right now, we're so polarized. One of the important things to do is to find things we can agree on. And I think we can all agree that these companies are not behaving responsibly. They have this massive political power. They weren't elected to it. They aren't in any way regulated or they haven't accepted responsibility for all the power they have. And we have to force change. And I think we're all going to feel really good if we bring them down to size, because people go, oh, well, I don't want to give up what I like. And you go, you're not going to have to give it up. I mean, one of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to continue to do business with less profit, which is what I think is the 99% probability, or 2 weeks later, somebody else is going to deliver the same services to you in a different business model. I mean, you know, they're blocking all that from happening, but if you got them out of the way, it would happen overnight. You know, my view is these guys, they are not bad people, but their culture is rotten. And the Valley's culture is twisted right now. And we should get back to a world where it's not all about shareholder value, that we recognize that employees matter, the communities where the employees live matter, the customers matter, the suppliers matter, and that the interests of all those should be balanced along with the shareholder. And that, you know, the country's not in a place where people are happy right now. No. And we're going to have to make changes. And I don't want to become an authoritarian, you know, country. And that's the way we've been going. And I'd like to get us back to I'd like to actually have capitalism again instead of this sort of gangster thing. I mean, I think Warren's right when she says that, that capitalism without rules is theft.
Well, you left us with some optimism.
No, I think we're going to get going in 2020. I think we're going to win this thing. And you know, what I can tell you is I've been at this for more than 2 years, and, you know, I get huge crowds every night because people know there's something wrong, and they want to be part of the solution. And the beautiful thing is there's so many different ways to contribute. I mean, let's just say you're a parent and you got kids in elementary school. Well, there's a bunch of really obvious things to do. I mean, why do we let Chromebooks into schools? Why do we allow Google Docs into schools? I mean, all those things. Chromebooks are about getting kids addicted to YouTube. Google Docs are about getting all this data from the kids. Well, I don't think we want that. Don't let the schools force you to use Facebook groups to organize things. You can use email. You can use texting, right?
And the book has quite a few other things, people can take.
Yeah, I mean, the book is it's basically a thriller within three chapters of what to do about it, right?
Oh, it's a fascinating story.
And, you know, I look at all this stuff and I just go, there's so many things we can do, and we can each do our own thing. And I just think, you know, let's get kids playing outside again, and let's just not be afraid all the
yes.
time, you know?
Well, Roger McNamee, thanks so much for coming into KBOO
and
for writing
here.
Such an important book.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking with Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been a special News and Public Affairs Day broadcast for KBOO's Spring Membership Drive. Many thanks to Roger for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.